Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emmanuel, we teach Messianic Judaism for all nations. If you find these teachings helpful, please share them with your friends and family. Help us advance the teachings of the kingdom, and remember to support Beth Emmanuel with your prayers and financial gifts.
I want to begin this morning by reading you a very short piece of mail, which is the kind of email and mail that we routinely get at First Fruits of Zion, sometimes at Beth Emmanuel as well, but very often at First Fruits of Zion. So this comes from somebody who calls himself Kepha, that apparently is his name, which would be Peter, of course. It says, "Why do you cite the words of rabbis when you know that the Talmud is evil? Traditions of men. The Talmud speaks evil lies about Yeshua, Yeshua's mother, and speaks death of Yeshua's followers. The oral law is man-made, not God-made." Kepha. All right, so that's the kind of mail that we get on an almost daily basis. So I thought you might like to hear an answer to this, because this is a theme that we encounter in the Messianic movement, and maybe it bears some explanation for why we practice Messianic Judaism. So here's the typical reply: "Thanks for writing to First Fruits of Zion, and thanks for reading Idrash. We use Jewish sources like the Talmud because we are a Messianic Jewish ministry practicing and teaching Messianic Judaism. The Talmud is part of the broader religious literature of Judaism. We are not part of the Hebrew Roots movement, which denigrates both Judaism and Christianity as heretical, apostate abominations. Extra-biblical literature and rabbinic literature provide the contextual, literary, social, and religious framework for the Gospels and the New Testament. Contrary to popular anti-Semitic rhetoric, the Talmud is not evil. Instead, it is a repository of legal argumentation, various opinions, traditions, and discussions on biblical text. The Talmud does contain references to characters which many have mistaken for Yeshua of Nazareth or other New Testament characters, but those stories and references present anachronisms which make them impossible to correctly associate with Yeshua of Nazareth. The oral law is man-made inasmuch as it consists of legal precedents determined by earlier courts of law, but that authority was vested into the courts of law by the Torah itself," see Exodus 18. Deuteronomy 17, "Grace and peace, First Fruits of Zion." So that's a typical kind of answer. And it's sort of a softball answer regarding the oral law. But I thought we should talk about this a little bit today, since this is our Torah portion, at least the Deuteronomy 17 part. In our Torah portion, we heard these words in Deuteronomy 17, beginning in verse 10. It says, "You shall do according to the terms of the verdict which they declare to you, from that place which the Lord chooses. You shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, according to the terms of the Torah which they teach you, according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you to the right or to the left." So Moses speculated that many cases coming before the local courts, the local judges, might be too difficult for them to decide. So Deuteronomy 17 indicates that capital cases like idolatry, homicide, assault, should be commuted to a higher court. And Moses describes the highest court as the legislative body that operates out of the place that the Lord your God chooses. That is going to be Jerusalem, as we know. So on the basis of Deuteronomy 17, verse 8, Jewish law determined that capital cases couldn't be tried outside of the high court. And this explains why death penalties have been suspended until such a time as a high court is reconvened in Jerusalem. So in the days of the apostles, you know that the high court that was in Jerusalem was called the Great Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is actually a Greek word for assembly or council. But the Great Sanhedrin was presided over by a chief called a Nasi, the president or the prince of the Sanhedrin, corresponding to Moses presiding over the 70 elders in the wilderness and presided over in the days of the apostles, at least by the high priest. And they seem to have both have authority on this council. The Jewish judicial system contained several levels of appeal between that local court and the high court of the Sanhedrin, but the decision of the Sanhedrin, once it was made, was absolute. The Torah gave the Sanhedrin the jurisdiction to bind or to loose, which is language we learn from the Gospels. That means to forbid or to permit. That means that legislators on the Sanhedrin had the authority to interpret the Torah and to tell people how to apply it. That's what bind and loose meant. So readers of the New Testament come at this from a disadvantage because we have only, if that's your whole exposure to the court system, the Jewish court system, we have only a narrow window on the Sanhedrin, a narrow perspective, a brief glimpse of the institution at the height of its corruption, shortly before the fall of Jerusalem, which explains why Christian teachers tend to characterize the Sanhedrin as an illegitimate body of legislators that had hijacked God's authority over Israel. In reality, we learn in the Torah that God himself ordained the institution of the high court to settle difficult cases and to decide questions of Torah. And he even took the spirit that was upon Moses and placed it upon the 70 legislators, which is an important facet. That is to say that he invested his inspiration, his divine spirit of inspiration through which he was speaking through Moses into the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a noble and godly institution with the biblical authority to interpret the Torah. Unfortunately, at times, scoundrels like the Sadducees overran it. But we can say the same thing of the monarchy. Were there not wicked kings that ruled over Judea and over Israel? And yet we don't say that the institution of the monarchy was illegitimate. Or how about the institution of prophets? Were there not wicked prophets? Were there not false prophets? Yet we don't say that the institution of the prophets was illegitimate. Even though there is no Sanhedrin today that holds civil authority, the law to observe the authority of the Sanhedrin is still applicable, because the rulings of previous Sanhedrins have been passed on in the form of the body of tradition, which comprises part of the oral Torah, the Mishnah, the Talmud, as our emailer was referring to, traditions of men. So the Torah says that the decision of the Sanhedrin must be obeyed, it says specifically, according to the terms of the Torah which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you. The phrase terms of the Torah is actually pi ha-Torah, the mouth of the Torah, according to the mouth of the Torah that they teach you. In other words, the decisions, verdicts, and rulings that the Sanhedrin issued formed an orally transmitted Torah. That's the implication here. Much of the body of law that Judaism identifies as the oral Torah has been transmitted from the decisions and deliberations of the Sanhedrin. And the strength of Jewish tradition and oral law rests upon the commandments of Deuteronomy 17, which warns us not to turn away from this high court's decision to the left or the right. So the rabbis teach that the words, that they will declare to you, and you shall not turn aside, refer to then this body of oral Torah, which is embodied, of course, in the Talmud that the person writing to us was inquiring about. Much like our legal system in this country, which looks to the past court decisions in order to find a case precedent to interpret current circumstances, Jewish law defers to the decisions and rulings made by earlier generations of legislators. So a court cannot overturn the ruling of an earlier court unless the judges on the court are greater, both in terms of number and in terms of wisdom, which is difficult to ascertain. The commandment to obey the great Sanhedrin then creates the basis for a unified religious standard, that is, the Jewish religion, Judaism. If God left every person to interpret the Bible, to interpret the Torah for himself, then there would be as many versions of Judaism as there are versions of Protestant Christianity, or more, because they've had longer to divide. So that would mean there would be 36,000 different Judaisms if it was up to everybody to determine the meaning of the text themselves. In short, the Jewish people do not have the biblical right to disregard the rulings and laws instituted by traditional authority. And this means that even if we think that the sages got it wrong, in fact, even if we know that the sages got it wrong, it doesn't matter. We still comply with their decision. All right, so that's the premise of a unified Jewish religion. Are Jewish believers then also under the authority of the sages and Jewish tradition and the Sanhedrin and the oral law and so forth? This is the next question that always comes up. Are Messianic Jews beholden to the decisions issued by those judges who themselves were not necessarily believers in Yeshua? I mean, why would they be? Well, our master actually weighs in on this question. He answers this authoritatively, definitively. He says to his disciples, his Jewish disciples, he says, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in the chair of Moses. And chair of Moses is an idiom for the Sanhedrin. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe. So in this passage, where chair of Moses is referring to the Sanhedrin, without any doubt, he's saying, yes, the answer to your question is yes. Now, we know that the loyalty of Messianic Jews belongs first and foremost to the king, to King Yeshua, the king of Israel. He is the final authority. But the authority of the king, the way the legal system in Israel works, the authority of the king does not compete with the authority of the legislative branch. Think of our government. The president has his own sphere of authority, and Congress has their own sphere of authority, and the Supreme Court has their own sphere of authority, and these different branches of government relate to one another, and they work together, and they sometimes challenge one another, but each one has its own domain of jurisdiction. So too, the king of Israel has his domain of jurisdiction, and the high court had their domain of jurisdiction, the priesthood had their domain of jurisdiction, and so forth. Our master Yeshua did not come to overturn Judaism. He did not come to start a new religion. He endorsed the authority of the Torah, and he endorsed the authority of the sages. Nevertheless, as we find, opinions within the Messianic Jewish movement are divided over this issue. Some Messianic Jews accept the authority of Jewish tradition with the exception of the traditional prohibition of believing in Yeshua, of course, which if you accepted that, you wouldn't have a Messianic Judaism. The Sadducee and Sanhedrin rejected Yeshua's Messianic claims and forbade believers, his disciples, to speak in his name. However, we have to remember, so you might say, well, therefore, we can't accept the authority of Jewish tradition, the authority of the Sanhedrin. But we have to remember that that was a ruling from a hijacked Sanhedrin. And the actual legitimate authority in the Sanhedrin, as evidenced by the Nasi at that time, Rabban Gamliel, ruled against prohibiting Messianic believers, as we read in Acts chapter 5, verses 35 through 40. So the real ruling of the Sanhedrin, if we're going back to the Sanhedrin, is to not stand against the believers and the faith in Yeshua of Nazareth. You can read it yourself in Acts chapter 5. Most Messianic Jews, nevertheless, reject traditional Judaism out of hand. They accept little to none of traditional law. And that Protestant reflex explains why Messianic Judaism sometimes looks more like charismatic Christianity than it does like Judaism. Maimonides argued that a central authority is necessary for the observance of Torah, and you cannot have the observance of Torah without a central authority. If living out the scriptures was simply a matter of every person deciding for themselves whether or not a commandment applied or how to keep a commandment, then the faith would disintegrate into chaos. So here's Maimonides' quote on the subject. He says, if every scholar had the power to make modifications to Jewish law, the multitude of disputes and differences of opinion would have produced an injurious effect. Therefore, it was commanded that of the sages, only the great Sanhedrin and none less should have this power, and whoever opposed their decision should be put to death. For if any critic were allowed to dispute the decision of the Sanhedrin, the object of this law, that is the Torah, would not be attained. Because most Messianic communities reject traditional authority, our situation today can be compared to the situation as it was in the days of the judges, where it says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did as he damn well pleased. That's Judges 21, verse 25, according to my brother Stephen's translation of the text. One doesn't need to travel very far to see this problem manifest in Messianic Judaism and the Hebrew Roots movement. Without central traditional authority, the Torah, which should be a forum for unity, provides us with 613 things to argue about and to divide over and to break into further factions. Next question. Are God-fearing Gentile believers, Messianic Gentiles, that is, also subject to the authority of the Sanhedrin, the sages, and Jewish tradition and the oral law? As we've already determined that Messianic Jews are. What about the Gentiles? Beyond any doubt, a believer's loyalty belongs first to King Yeshua. There can be no question of divided loyalties here. As we've already seen, however, the authority of Yeshua does not contradict or even compete with the authority of traditional Judaism, except in regard to the customary dogma of rejecting belief in Yeshua. Neither the Torah nor the New Testament established an alternative center of authority or judicial system for Gentile believers. This should be telling. The God-fearing Gentile believers submitted to the authority of the apostles and the Jewish believers, and they, the apostles and the Jewish believers, in turn, submitted to the Sanhedrin and the Jewish authorities in all things except their devotion to Messiah. Since the God-fearing Gentiles in the apostolic era still congregated in synagogues along with the Jewish people, then it made sense for the apostles to require those Gentiles to submit to Jewish authority along with them. And we see this explicitly stated in the book of Romans. In Romans chapter 13, Paul writes to Gentile believers in Rome, telling them to subject themselves to both secular and religious authorities. He says, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God. And those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinances of God. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. In this passage from Romans, the words, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinances of God and will receive condemnation, sound like a paraphrase of Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 11. Nevertheless, one should not be confused here and suppose that this means that a God-fearing Gentile believer is therefore required to take on all the observances, customs, traditions of an Orthodox Jewish person. On the contrary, traditional Judaism discourages Gentiles from studying and practicing those things which do not pertain to them as Gentiles. That is to say that traditional Jewish authority itself exempts God-fearing Gentile believers from taking on the whole load of traditional Jewish law. The rabbis teach that Gentiles should not observe all the stringencies of traditional Jewish law. At the same time, a Gentile who voluntarily chooses to practice the commandments of the Torah, to which he is not obligated, should do so in accordance with Jewish tradition. He should not feel free to innovate and make things up. Maimonides states it this way. He says, we should not prevent a Gentile who desires to perform one of the Torah's commandments in order to receive reward from doing so, provided he performs it as required. This rule stands to reason. For example, suppose that a Gentile wants to keep the Sabbath. He must not change it then to a different day and say, I want to keep the Sabbath. I'll keep it on Tuesday. It's no longer the Sabbath if he does. Likewise, the Gentile who wants to keep the commandment, you can pick another commandment that doesn't necessarily apply to a Gentile, such as affixing a mezuzah on the doorpost of your house. The Gentile who decides to keep the commandment of affixing a mezuzah should probably do so in accordance with tradition then, with the traditional, and not reinterpret the commandment according to his own designs and ideas as if Judaism was illegitimate and he had the authority to define the meaning of the Torah's words. To whatever extent the God-fearing Gentile believer decides to engage in the practice of Messianic Judaism, and I believe that our apostles would encourage him to do so, he should do so in accordance with the traditional mode and expression, as the apostles themselves would have, and as our master Yeshua did. This does not mean that he or she needs to keep all the halakha and all the minutiae of the law. It only means that when he practices the Torah, he should do so along with Judaism and along with Jewish expression, and not in antithesis to Judaism.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.